Aloha, I'm Carlin Pipes, and you're listening to an Open Water Swimmers podcast.
Here we are with episode 8 of an Open Water Swimmers podcast. I'm still excited to say that. Thank you for joining me. I am seriously pumped about this week's guest. So, where do I begin? Well, she is not only one of the most decorated swimmers of all time, having broken 233, yes, 233 FINA world records at Masters level, 33 of which, by the way, still stand. She was also inducted into the Swimming Hall of Fame in 2017 and is the author of The Do-Over, her book, which tells the story of her struggles with addiction, coupled with being a rising swimming star and Olympic hopeful. She's also an inspirational swimming coach, teaching her faster freestyle clinics across the world, which is where I was lucky enough to first meet her. This chat was so frank and honest, and I hope you enjoy how open it was. Please, please make sure you listen to the end, because there is a gift waiting for you if you want it. Without saying any more, please welcome to the podcast from Hawaii, it's Carlin Pipes.
Carlin Pipes, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your morning in Hawaii on inauguration day of Joe Biden, I must say. Today is that day. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. It's such an honor to have you here.
Oh, aloha and good morning. Thanks for having me on the show. And yeah, it is actually a pretty special day. I think a lot of people are breathing a heavy, heavy sigh of relief. Some not so much, but those of us that are in this on this side of the field are saying, yay, finally time for a change.
Excellent. I think we should never really talk about politics, but I think we should all breathe a sigh of relief and move on. Excellent. So, Carlin, my first question to you is, why do you swim? Now, obviously, this is an Open Water Swimmers podcast, so not everyone starts in the open water. So it might be, you know, why did you take up swimming? Why do you continue to swim? And what is it specifically about the water that keeps you coming back?
Yeah, that is such a fantastic question, because there's so many directions in which you can go. And for me, I'm going to start with the purest and simplest one. I think what I have felt from the water from the very beginning was acceptance, appreciation, and of course, a later on, approval. But the acceptance, I think, you know, when I think I remember the very first time I had my very first swimming lesson at like the age of 4, opening up the door to the indoor facility and getting hit with that warm, humid blast of chlorinated air. And even to this day, as soon as I smell something like that, it could even be just walking into a loo or something. It's like, oh, it just takes me right back. And to that exciting first lesson when I was finally old enough to be taught, and just how warm and comforting the water felt as it embraced me in a warm hug. You know, that's the thing about the water. The water is hugging you. Like if your head's out of the water, you've got like 95% of your body getting a hug. So I just feel that acceptance. And I also feel non-judgment. The judgment can come from me personally, but the water doesn't judge me. The water has never judged me. The water has never said you're slow or fat or unattractive or not smart. The water just says, come on in and enjoy me and let me touch you all over.
Yeah.
Let me make you feel good. And it's really, really true. I mean, it's just this kind of, it is really kind of an out of body experience. I think that's a really good way of describing it, because you really float free.
Yeah.
You float free. And we fly. When you swim, you fly. You're flying over the bottom of a pool. You're flying over the bottom of a rocky beach. You're flying over, in Hawaii, we have drop-offs and lava ledges and things like that. And it's so, I mean, I get the sense that I'm free and I'm flying, and it's just beautiful. I mean, I don't think there's anything like it in the world. I went skydiving 2 years ago in New Zealand, and it was an amazing experience, but I will never do it again.
Yeah.
And the only reason why I could, like, it's freaked me out. because I was, you're falling at such a rapid speed, your brain can't connect with what's going on. And I was doing a tandem jump. And when I was floating around, this was like near Nelson on the South Island of New Zealand. And down below me, I saw a swimming pool, like a competition pool. And I was looking down at that and my stomach is churning and my head is freaking out. And if I just looked at that pool, I was fine as we kind of circled around it. It was kind of like, just look at the pool. How big is it? I wonder if it's open. There's a pool down there. And it just brought me peace and calm in this chaotic thing. So skydiving, not even close to swimming, swimming much better.
Love it. Love it. That feeling of coming home as you were plummeting towards Earth was drawing you in. So if we think about that moment of the little Carlin had been hit by chlorine and going in for, I guess, one of her first sort of learning to swim practice. I don't know. What was it about the water then that said, I'm going to do this again tomorrow, or I'm going to do this next week?
I think a big part of it was the actual physical water and how I felt in the water. And I was a skinny girl and it was cold outside. So that warmth, you know, just really was comforting. But what really, really made me want to come back the next day was working with the wonderful Red Cross. It was YMCA instructors that were teaching me how to swim. They were so supportive and so encouraging. And they just made me feel like I was achieving and I was good at something. And this was very important because what I was getting at the pool was this support and acceptance and appreciation and approval, but I wasn't feeling that at home. I was from an alcoholic home. My dad was actively drinking. My mom was in survival mode and there were five kids under the age of seven. So it was chaos. And I think I just found calmness in the pool and in the water. And I found what I was looking for from the instructors for what I wasn't getting at home, which was attention.
Yeah. Yeah. there's a lot there in what you speak about. Obviously you are not only one of the most decorated swimmers of all time, but you're also an incredibly accomplished teacher of swimming. Do you ever look back on those moments of utter encouragement and support, the time that you got away from home, as the sort of tiny little subconscious light bulb moment of, you know, I'm going to be an amazing teacher? Do you draw on that at all?
I've never thought of that before, but it really would be true because I think we teach the way we would like to be taught. And how we provide that message to whoever you're working with is how you like it delivered. It's kind of like we love the way we'd like to be loved. And I think that I probably did pick that up was that really, I mean, obviously my instructors really were encouraging, but they also wanted me to succeed. They wanted me to feel good about myself and learning how to swim and to learn the strokes and have that kind of feedback was just fantastic. And it really, you know, boosted your confidence. And the thing is, you would pack yourself up after your swimming lesson and you would be, you know, so elated and so warm and fuzzy from that experience. And then you walked in, I mean, we'll talk about this more later. You went home and it was nothing but warm. It was not at all warm and fuzzy. It was arguments and alcohol and anger. And so I think I just wanted to be at the pool more and more often. And I see that too with, whenever I work with somebody that really likes to swim underwater, especially a little kid, I always kind of think you're going underwater because the world goes away and they wish they could stay under. And it really is true. Cause in that underwater world, the hurt and the harm and the pain of the outer world disappears. And we just can be in that bubble until we need air and then we've got to come back up and face reality. But it's just comforting. Even if we're not breathing, it's comforting for my brain, at least. It just says, this is a safe place. Yeah. The outside world is not very safe.
Exactly right. And you're not alone in that feeling of the water making you feel present. And in so much of being present, you're able to shut the outside world out. And yes. I guess that's kind of what you're saying, that in that regard, obviously your situation was very unique.
You think I actually don't think it's unique. People that have read my book are saying, wow, you were writing my story. That was exactly what I felt like when I went to the pool and felt all of those wonderful warm and fuzzy feelings, and what it was like when I went home. People are saying, did you like crash my house? Because that's what I felt too.
Gosh,
and that's really amazing. And actually, it's very interesting. If you kind of look at elite athletes and their motivation for succeeding and the drive and the push, and that I've got to be at the top, come from a lack. It's not coming from this warm, happy place that they had in their family life. It's usually turmoil and abandonment issues. Michael Phelps is a great example. I mean, when Michael Phelps would win, did he sit there and go, yeah, I'm number one, like, woohoo, this is great? No, he hit the water hard. It was like, take that, world, I'm someone. And that pretty much was me at a point in time in my swimming career. It was kind of like I needed to keep getting that recognition to be somebody, because just being me wasn't enough.
Gosh,
and
wow.
So I had to be Carlin Pipe's world record breaker. And evolution of Carlin, I'm more than just a world record breaker.
Well, yes, absolutely. That's something that your book details so beautifully. What another thing that I find about knowing you personally and having read your book is the energy that you exude. I always say there's two types of people in life. There's radiators and there's drains. You are not just a radiator. You are a volcano of outward energy, and in your when I'm reading your book, you're just constantly uplifted. You constantly seem to be giving. And I made a note of in your book, you seem to have your capacity for retrospective forgiveness is absolutely astonishing for someone who is telling their story and, you know, very eloquently and beautifully, and we're seeing what you've gone through. Yet you're still giving out. You're still exuding all this wonderful energy. And I guess it's not really a question. It's more of a statement to kind of feed you. Is that something you recognize in yourself now, having sort of come to that point?
That's really insightful, Will. How do I best go about adding to that statement? I think we are only capable of giving forgiveness or letting somebody off the hook or exuding that kind of energy when we've forgiven ourselves. Because there was a lot of damage that I caused along the way. I harmed a lot of people, but the person that I harmed the most was myself. And coming to terms with what I had become as far as, basically a raging alcoholic, that I had to really, and missed a raging alcoholic that had thrown away opportunities, had disregarded talent and potential. And by the time, you know, there's a lot of self-loathing that happens when it comes to addictions. You really, really hate yourself because of not just what you become, but of the path that you took to get there. So the self-forgiveness was the first part. That really was huge. And once you can forgive yourself and not pass judgment on your past mistakes, you're able to offer that to other people. So it's just like they say in AA, you know, you can't give away what you don't have. So you actually have to internalize that yourself, which means you need to do a lot of soul searching, which is why the water is so amazing. I get in the water and it doesn't care. You know, it didn't care that I threw away all kinds of collegiate opportunities. It didn't care that I was an Olympic hopeful. It didn't care that I nearly died from alcoholism and my poor choices. It didn't care. It just said, come on back. I'm going to make you well. And I'll make you well. And that was the only promise the water gave me, was I will make you well. And it did. And it was amazing. And I still have this incredible relationship to water. Although, to tell you the truth, I'm not looking forward to hopping in a very cold pool in a few minutes, because swimmers don't like to get wet. We love to swim, but we don't like to get wet.
It's the jumping in. It's the jumping in that everybody hates, isn't it?
Liz, exactly.
You've reminded me of that moment in the book when you are not long into your recovery, I should say, and you have your first swims. You sort of swim like a 600, and then the next day you do an 800, and so on and so forth. And then very quickly, within a year, there you are back again, You know, swimming lifetime best, and you know, at the age of 25, you swim the fastest. Was it 100 fly? And it's just, I mean, your body must be remarkable to be able to do that.
Well, I actually, remarkable is not the right word. A miracle is really what it is, because of my alcohol abuse, which lasted from age 15 until age 31 when I got sober, you know, basically. And then I also had an eating disorder that ran concurrent with that addiction. And people kind of go, well, that's kind of crazy. It's like, no, it's very, very common. So we had coaches back then that would have us weigh in before we could race or swim. I remember having my world famous Olympic coach saying, you're too pretty to be fat, Carlin. You have all these tapes playing in your head, but the two addictions, bulimia, was a way to gain control of your food and in your intake, and then binge and purge. And then the alcohol was a way to numb yourself and to forget. So those two addictions were like two sides of a coin. Mm. And I did them both well. Because you know what, I'm an achiever no matter what. I mean, I'm not going to do anything halfway. So the miracle is that, considering when I went into that rehab, I had been drinking round the clock for about a month straight. I hadn't had a drink in 6 hours. And my mom and I were in an emergency room waiting to get a bed in the rehabilitation center. And she leans over and she says, and we're having a conversation. Nobody in the world would know that I was completely inebriated because I was high functioning drunk. And we're in the emergency room, we're waiting an hour and a half, and she leans over and she says, well, it's a good thing you're not dying. And little did she know that if you looked at my chem panel from my blood work, that my potassium levels were borderline alive. I was could have gone into a fibrillating heart cardiac event, any number one of those things. I mean, it was really touch and go. And when I got upstairs and into that bed and the delirium tremor started, I really did feel like I was dying. It was like I was getting an exorcist. Exercise.
Yeah.
Exorcist. Oh. Yeah. It is a miracle that I'm even here, because the timing of that all worked out exactly right. Had my mom not intervened and taken me to a doctor's appointment on Friday and we had gotten one on Monday, I probably would have been dead. God. No, I would have been dead. Yeah. So all the swimming and the getting back my speed and all that stuff was just really the metamorphosis of me going from this unhealthy drunk to cleaning up everything and getting back in the water with the right intentions, which was to just get better, to be well.
You talk about the healing nature of the water. I mean, obviously living in Hawaii. And I think that's incredibly true. Gosh, it's such a beautiful read. And
thank you. The do-over. We keep saying the book. The do-over.
The do-over. There you go. The do-over. So my next question to you, Carlin, then. What are your earliest memories of swimming in the open water?
Ooh. So I grew up in an area called Lompoc, which is just above Santa Barbara in California. And the water was very, very cold. It was right above Point Conception. So it's kind of like the line between Northern California and Southern California. So whenever we went to the beach, it was a windswept, cold, dark sand kind of experience. So when I was little, like eight and under, going to the beach was not like a swimmy thing, you know. When we moved to San Diego when I was eight, I think we moved right before the summer, and my very first open water race and probably my very first open water swim was at 8 years old. It was at the Coronado 4th of July rough water. And they had a 250 meter out through the surf, down the beach a little bit back in open water event. And I remember just swimming head up breaststroke the entire time. I made it through the course and I came in dead last. But during the award ceremony, they gave an award for the people that came in last, the boy and girl that came in last. And I got Baskin Robbins gift certificates for ice cream for getting last. But I vividly remember laying in my bed that night and still feeling the movement of the ocean. And it didn't scare me. It was scary during the event, but it didn't scare me. It was just like something kind of comforting, you know? Mm. And I think a couple months later, I swam the La Jolla Rough Water Swim, the epic, iconic La Jolla Rough Water Swim. And by then I put my head down and I had numbers on my back and I was chasing girls. And that was it. At age 8, first open water race, probably by 9 or 10, we had some really cool coaches on my team and they loved taking us down to Imperial Beach and we would swim around the pier and we would play in the surf. And it just really evolved. And to the point where I just loved racing in open water. Mm. And at age 16, I became a pool lifeguard. At age 17, I became an ocean lifeguard. And I was an ocean lifeguard basically until my late 20s. So I, you know, parlayed my love of being around the ocean and being in the ocean by becoming a paid surf lifesaver, basically.
Gosh.
So that was it. And I just, you know, it's just, in San Diego, people think that the water, it's hard to talk about cold water now because my version of cold water compared to what people are doing right now in open water swimming, in this ice swimming and this cold water, it's like pansy wansy, but you know, San Diego water is not warm.
No.
It's just so freeing to swim. I mean, Will, what do you feel like when you swim in the open water versus in the pool?
Well, this isn't about me, but well, for me, the pool is a place for metrics, and the open water is a place to be at peace, is a place to enjoy. And those for me are the two kind of glaring distant differences. You must identify with that hugely.
Oh yeah. Last week I did a post where, you know, I was swimming in the pool and everybody's like, well, you're in Hawaii. Why aren't you swimming in Hawaii? Your pool is so cold. And I have an endless pool at my house, which I've been in only like 3 times since COVID because I have a beautiful ocean to go explore. Yeah. And I have people to swim with. And that is really, I think that's the thing, is open water swimming is best enjoyed with somebody else. And I'm grateful I have a really wonderful training partner here. And often my husband is on a stand-up paddleboard. And so we kind of go out and we go explore. And then I also had an opportunity. My husband, Christopher, is Canadian from British Columbia. So I was able to get into Canada this summer because I'm married to a Canadian. I was able to spend 2 months in Kelowna, British Columbia. And I have created some open water swim camps that I'm going to be hosting there this summer. Sweet. So we live on a 83-mile long lake.
Nice.
Yeah. Like nice. I am literally 500 steps from our mobile estate in a 55 and over park, AKA trailer park, 500 steps from my door to the water. And that's great.
Lovely. Yeah. What does open water swimming mean to you now? The Carlin Pipes living in Hawaii, able to swim in the ocean with big pelagics. and not that I'm jealous. And how has that changed since that first memory of it as the 8-year-old Carlin doing a 250-meter race through the surf? It's a very big question, but are you able to quantify how it's changed and what it's meant to you along the way?
So that is fun. That's really fun because as I'm listening to the question, I'm thinking, okay, draw an arc of first experience to the end and let's go chronological. So over here we have 8-year-old Carlin and now we have 58-year-old Carlin. So we have a 50-year span of open water swimming. What I have done is I've actually, it's not an arc, it's a full circle. I've gone back to little Carlin. So when I get in the water now in the ocean, for a long time, it was about a workout. It was like, how far am I going? How fast am I going? Give me the metrics, right? And throughout COVID, I have metamorphosized back into 8-year-old Carlin, filled with wonder and awe and appreciation for this beautiful thing we call Mother Ocean. And it has been really amazing. And it has been a sequence of things. So when COVID happened and the pool shut down, oh no, what are we going to do without the clock, right? So then we started replicating training in the ocean. We'd swim between buoys, we'd do intervals, we'd do flip turns, for gosh sakes, because you know, you got a somersault because one day you're going to get back in the pool and you don't want to lose it. Well, as we gradually kept swimming and COVID went on longer and longer, our swims got longer, not the distance, just the time we spent in the water. And I, this friend of mine, Dave Gibson, we started just slowing down. We don't have a pace. We just swim. Mm. And that swim can accommodate any speed. And we look for big things. So we are looking where we heard whales the other day. We look for the mantas, the dolphins, the spotted eagle rays. But when we don't find the bigger things, and then we look for sharks too. We've seen a couple little ones, not big ones. And then if we haven't found anything big, then we start looking a little bit smaller. Oh, there's a school of puffer fish. Oh, did you see that eel? Oh, and then if we can't find that, then we start looking for even smaller things. It's like, did you see that coral? Did you see that? And we just, now we're going down to the little tiny fish. And it's just really fun because we get out, we have cameras, we swim with cameras in our bathing suits, and we get out and we just go, that was a great swim, you know. And then, oh, we've been playing in the surf lately. We've had a lot of surf, and we don't usually have surf in this one location. So at first it was like, get through the surf, it's scary, it's dangerous. Then the next time was like, hey, we got caught inside, that was pretty fun. Now we purposely put ourselves in the surf to tumble and toss and get bubbles all around us. And it's like, wow. Oh, and then we find caves. We have a cave that we go to, and it's a sea cave, and it has a little bit of an inlet, and we get in there and we're just kind of testing the limits on Mother Nature. So I would say that this whole full circle, not an arc, is what's happened in my open water swimming. It's gone from playful to intense, back to playful again. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. Of course, we do swim some distance, but it's not a heart rate up kind of thing. And yeah. It's just, and Hawaii is so amazing. I found two black sand beaches I'd never been to before. And they're more like black pebble. And I was down at the oldest fishing village left in Hawaii, down south in Mi'ilolii. And that was really cool. A lot of Hawaiian energy down there. And you can pull that energy from the ocean and realize that when you disconnect from land and you untether yourself from something solid, you really let go and you become a much bigger part of this universe. Mm. You know, you become this ocean is connected to every other ocean, mm-hmm. molecular. And by doing that, you're not disconnecting. Actually, you're connecting with something much bigger than yourself.
So let me ask you this then. Has the healing nature of the water, has that remained consistent all the way through that circle? Or has the healing nature of the water changed?
I believe there was a time. So when I first got sober and I got back in the water and realized that I still could swim pretty decently and started actually getting faster than I was when I was younger, It took a twist. It went from, wow, this is great. I love being in the water. Look what happened. See how fast I can swim. I started putting demands upon myself as I progressed throughout my swimming career. And it became more of a job and more egocentric. In other words, if I don't train hard enough, I won't be able to perform well enough to break records. And if I don't break records, then who the heck am I? So it actually did take a kind of a dark turn where I was not a very kind person to my ex-husband, Eric. I pretty much detail that in the book. It was kind of like, get out of my way, world. If you're going to keep me from swimming or keep me from reaching my goals, I'm going to not be a very nice person to you. Mm-hmm. And I went through a stage like that, and I look back at it and I can see it was basically me just keeping my ego fed, feeling like I had to be something as opposed to just being in the water. You know, I'm a human being, not a human doing, but I turned into a human doing. And I really, really embraced the fact that after my marriage fell apart in 2009 and I went on a, you know, kind of a soul searching trip, I realized, could I give myself permission to step off the blocks? Who was Carlin when she's not racing? And I stepped off the blocks and I started teaching more. I started, was writing a column for Swimming World magazine and sharing, you know, kind of my insights on motivation and training and technique and just all the things that go around with swimming. And I found that I really, really enjoyed giving back to the sport as opposed to just taking from it. Mm-hmm. And you probably heard that story many times before, but it really rang true with me. And I realized I really love helping people figure out an easier way to swim faster. And that's how we first met, remember, in London at St.
Yeah,
Paul's.
It's absolutely right. Yeah. And, you know, it was actually that moment that I realized I could swim faster that I started to take it seriously. It was my brother that said to me, "You will never be a faster swimmer than me." And I started swimming, and then I saw a notice for your swim camp and went and did it, and then was able to join the master's program as a result. So it was all thanks to your faster freestyle. Yeah. Cause I'd never broken my stroke down. Like, I swam competitive as a kid really badly, but I'd never really broken my stroke down. And that's what I loved, you know, about some simple ideas from your clinic to actually get you to swim with balance, right?
Balance. Yeah. You know, and people don't realize actually swimming has a lot of moving parts, and this we can segue into a little bit of stroke technique, but really when you think about swimming, the number one goal in freestyle swimming in particular, do you know what it is? The number one goal, you already said it.
Balance.
Okay. So what makes freestyle, what makes balance in freestyle so difficult? What makes it different than butterfly backstroke and breaststroke? Well, as far as balance.
Because it's asymmetric.
You got it. Ding, 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 ding. It's the only stroke where you take your head out of alignment to get a breath. So you are moving an 8 to 9 pound or 4 kilo bowling ball every time you take a breath. And so moving forward is great, but if you keep losing your balance, you've got to mitigate that. So when you see good swimmers, they're floating on the surface. And that's the first thing I saw when I saw you. Great body position, relaxed, fast. But a couple of things, we actually got rid of things. We didn't really add things. We got rid of a longer pole and more playful on the arm recovery. But when you see a really good swimmer, they're floating. When you see a poor swimmer, they're falling. And what they're doing is they're losing their balance. And the faster freestyle that I teach basically is very similar to how ancient people swam, or if you were doing water polo, or you're doing a rescue stroke where you're trying to keep sight of your victim, you're going to swim kind of more with your head up, looking forward, wider entry, shorter pull, and survival swimming basically. Yeah. Of course, we swim with our head down, but it's the same premise. It's a very ancient stroke with a little bit of a new twist, and that's it right. Keeps your balance. Yeah. So you did great at the workshop, and it's been fun watching you progress over the years because you got freaking fast. You did beat your brother, right?
Oh yeah. He's long gone now. Bless him. He's long gone. He's in my wake. No, my achievement was to go sub 19 on a 1500. I went 18:30 on a 1500 short.
Yeah, that's so fast. At what age? How old were you when you did that?
33.
Yeah.
So. But then I'm reading your book, and then I think you said when you were 34, you went 1748. Yeah. Was that short or long?
That was short. I think when I was 35 to 39, I went 1756 long. I wasn't a big fan of the 1500, although I think what's kind of even way cooler and there's a little bit of backstory to this. You know, we have these 5K and 10K postal swims where you swim in a 50 meter pool and you have somebody. I did a 5K swim one time. And this was in my mid 30s when I was racing a lot. So basically I had tapered and raced probably 6 or 7 swimming competitions week after week after week after week and done really, really well. But the point is I was not swimming high volume yardage. I was tapered. I would swim the meet. I would swim probably 6 or 7,000 meters during the day because it was prelims and finals. Do that for a couple of days, basically swim really hard, do a lot of recovery, swim really hard, do a lot of recovery. During the week, I would do a kind of a regular workout, then an easy workout, and then I would race again on the weekend. Long story short, at the end of that time, I timed a 5K swim in the pool and I went an hour 3, which was like 1:13 per 100 meters long course.
That's crazy fast.
And I broke it down, Will. I went a 1500, a 1500, a 1000, a 1000. And I went 18 something on the first 1500. I went 18 high because whatever I did is I went like 1849. I took a 10 second break, drank something, pushed off the wall. And whenever I pushed off the wall after taking that little bit of break, I always went a little bit faster for that next thing. So it was like a reset button. And I had a friend of mine that was swimming every other 100 next to me to keep me company, he couldn't keep up. And so here I am, I'm tapered. And when I say tapered, I'm just saying I had no endurance background at that point. I've been racing for 2 months. So I just made me realize if you have a pretty solid base of training, it doesn't go away. It's just a matter of how can you tap into it? And that's one of the biggest gifts of COVID, I would say, that I have experienced. I went from March until September, not going into a pool at all. I just swam open water. And as I said, it was very easy paced, wearing a wetsuit often when I was in Kelowna. And I got in the pool, in a short course meter pool. I warmed up about 1500 and I'm thinking, oh, this isn't going to go good. So I put my paddles on, I pushed off the wall and I thought, well, I'll do 100. I was like 118. I was like, wait a second. So let me go another on left on the 130, did a 117. And I ended up doing 10 of them on 130, holding between 116 and 118s. And I was like, hey, I'm not slow. It didn't go away. Of course, I went home and took a 2-hour nap. what it taught me was very important. First of all, the speed is still there. It doesn't go away. You can tap back into it. Number two, we need time off. We need breaks from the metrics of swimming. We need the mental break where we just learn to love the water and play again. And number three is, oh my gosh, is swimming in a pool a great workout? We need the pool. We need the pool for those push-offs, because every time you push off or do a turn, it's a burpee. You swim 3,000 meters in a 25 meter pool, you got 120 streamlined stretch-offs, shoulder stretches, and burpees. So we need a balance, I think, of both of those to be good for our body.
I never thought of that, actually.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's extra stretching without any extra additional time in your day. So streamline push off, shoulder flexibility, strengthen core alignment, hip flexors, psoas, all that. You're doing a crunch when you do the turn. That's a somersault, explosive jump. So you're getting a plyometric explosive jump with your legs. It's good for you. So you've got to intersperse a bit of the metrics in the pool with your open water swimming to keep the body alignment and strong and supple. Mm. Long swimming is great, but you got to do some time in the pool.
And so I guess what I think of it, that muscle memory for you coming back to swimming after you had come out of rehab and you knew that you had to swim, you know, to get yourself well, that muscle memory was all still there. But it was surprising to me how quickly it all came back for you. It was astonishing.
Yeah.
But that muscle memory is just, it's just so in tune. It's just so there. It's almost like you could do it all, you know, you could do it all while you were asleep.
Exactly. And I think, okay, so the muscle memory is one thing you're never going to forget. Like, you know, you say you're on holiday and somebody gets in the pool and they could be completely out of shape, you know, pasty as all get out, you know, some British swimmer, but they push off the wall and they take one stroke and immediately you go, swimmer, right?
Yeah.
You cannot fake. Being what your body knows, and we can do it in our sleep. Like those first flip turns that I did after not being in the water, I didn't think 2 seconds about them. And there's about probably 40 steps to a good flip turn, right? The judgment of the wall, the turning, the twisting, all that kind of stuff, things that we can just do on autopilot. But I think I had so much success in those early, early days was my attitude of gratitude. I was so grateful to be alive. So anything not dead was really cool. And acceptance at its lowest level, which I did when I first got back in, because I could barely swim, like I said, 400 to 600 meters, accepting it at its lowest level and just grateful that I had this sport that I could still do that would heal me. And and the water did heal me. And then gradually I got stronger and, you know, it was kind of like the little engine that could, as I got stronger in the water and my brain fog started clearing from all the years of alcohol abuse. And I got better about eating because I was very malnourished, learned that food was fuel, not something to be thrown up. you know, I learned all kinds of stuff. And as a result, all of those the records. I mean, I think I set my first master's world record, no, second world record, because I broke one when I was 25 in the 400 medley.
Yeah.
And that record only proved that I did have potential to go to the Olympics, and I did have a lot of talent, and that I clearly was wasting it, and I just drank even more. So my second world record was about 5 months sober, 200 meter backstroke, short course meters. That was fun. I remember that day well.
It's astonishing after everything you put your body through to get to that level. I mean, I'm in awe.
But Will, I want to say something about that. Because I was salvaged, is a good word, I realized at the very beginning of my early sobriety, you know, a lot of people get sober and then they drink again and get sober and drink again. And relapses are quite common. But I knew right then and there that this was a one ticket ride. I knew that I needed to prize this like no other thing in my life, that I had been given this gift and it was mine to do with what I wanted, and that I was probably saved for a reason. And my real goal was not to swim fast. It was to figure out what was the reason I was saved when so many people are not. I mean, this disease kills. I've lost many, many friends, people that I've known over the years that, you know, looked like they were just big, you know, partiers, and the party continued and until their death. And there was no party left in them when they were isolated and alone, hiding. And we talked about this, is like, nobody knew that I had this massive secret that I was a raging alcoholic, because you get really good at hiding your secrets. Mm-hmm. And when you get sober, you realize you're only as sick as your secrets. And the only way to get well is to share those secrets. And when you do share those secrets with people, especially close friends, or even people that you know, your family and friends, we think that we're going to get yelled at. You know, it's like, William, I can't believe you did that to yourself. No. Most people say, all right, let's get you some help. That's what my mom did. I thought she was going to be so mad. She said, no, let's just get you some help. When I finally revealed that I was an alcoholic, she just said, I want to help you. And that's what most of your friends and family will say. Let's get you some help. What can I do to help? Because at that point, you do need help, because clearly your best thinking has gotten you down this pretty crappy road. You're going to need some better thinking to get you out of it. And that's not going to be your thinking. It's somebody, something greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity, because my life was completely insane. And I have a really funny open water story for you. It's in the book. When I was in my late 20s, still drinking heavily, I still wanted to swim. But because I was drinking in the morning, noon, and night, I couldn't go to the local municipal pool, because anybody would get within 2 feet of me would be able to smell the alcohol on my breath. You've been that person at the pool when you smell somebody that's been either drank the night before or has had a couple martinis for lunch. Alcohol is so easy to detect. So I couldn't swim at the local pool. So I came up with a brilliant idea. I was living in Coronado. It's an island off of San Diego. And I would walk down to a restaurant where I used to work, where I'd been fired many times. And I found the owner and I go, hey, Steve, I'm going to go out and swim in the San Diego Bay. And if I'm not back in like an hour, send the Coast Guard out looking for me. So I would go wander into the bay, drunk as a skunk, and swim laps, dodging aircraft carriers, fishing vessels, sailboats. I mean, by myself. But it was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I still wanted to swim, but I knew I couldn't swim around other people. So that was my brilliant idea, which could have killed me so easily. But that is the insanity of addiction. It makes you think that great ideas like that, or poor ideas, really bad ideas, really, really bad ideas, are great ideas. And, you know, I gratefully, I made it back alive. So,
God. I mean,
take a look at San Diego Bay. It's not very big between the San Diego, the city, and Coronado, the island. And where I was swimming, literally, I would almost bump into aircraft carriers.
God. Thank God you're a fast swimmer. You're able to move out of the way slightly.
Yeah. But yeah, I got my workout done. So tick.
I mean, there's ways of doing it, Colin. And that's certainly up there. Well, go.
But it just gives you the idea of how the addictive brain works. You know, I'm still trying to get a need met, which was I still wanted to swim, and I had to figure out the wonkiest way to do it. And that was it. Yeah. That's why risky, dangerous behavior is just right on par for people with addictions, because I'm still trying to get that fix. And for that time, that my swimming was my fix at that point, and alcohol.
But the most important thing was not being found out, presumably.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. That's it. The shame and the secrecy is what I didn't want it to be found out. Yeah. Mm. So yeah.
God, what a story. So open water swimming has always had a little degree of fear factor for me. That might be why it's so addictive. I don't know. But to what extent do you identify with that? And is there a particular sort of event or story that comes to mind in Hawaii with the big pelagics? I don't know. That comes to mind. I'm only saying that because I'm so jealous. I can hear the birds in the background. I'm like,
I have a lot of respect for the ocean. I have kind of a bit of a ritual when I get in the water. I like to bob up and down 3 times. And as I'm doing that, I'm just kind of softly releasing air and taking a nice soft breath in. And what I say to the water is, I love you, water. Thank you for being in my life. I realize I'm entering an environment that, as comfortable as I am, is still a foreign place to me. And may I proceed with caution? And I basically talk to Madame Pele, which is the island god of our volcano, and just ask for permission. And I try and really, it's very present moment awareness, because I actually am such a swimmer and a Pisces, by the way, that I can't differentiate. When I get in the water, aside from the temperature, I don't notice a difference that I'm wet or dry. Like the water to me, and I don't notice a difference between swimming in a pool and open water. Water is water to me. I just am so at peace and it's so comfortable with it. So anyway, I use that little ritual, and it just is a conscious awareness that I am someplace other than land and that I should be respectful. Yeah. So that said, we have a lot of marine life, and I really haven't had any scares with them. When I first saw a shark, it was a reef shark. And I was like, is that a shark? Oh, it's a shark. Instead of like, is that a shark? It's a shark. But I did have an incident a couple of weeks ago. Christopher and I were up north, and it was really choppy and windy, and we thought we saw a pod of dolphins offshore. So he gets to stand a paddleboard ready, and I put on a little mini wetsuit and some fins, and I start swimming out to it. And I keep seeing, oh yeah, they're still out there, but I'm like, this is not the same behavior as what I see dolphins doing. But I'm charging out there and I'm swimming out. I'm like, oh, I want to see the dolphins. I want to see the dolphins. And I get about, I don't know, maybe 50 meters away. And I look up and I see a little black glinty thing. And I'm like, oh, there they are. And then I looked at it in the light, and it was now about 25 meters from me. And I was like, I can't figure out what I'm looking at. And it's not dolphins. And I'm like, so what is it? It's like, whatever it is, you're not that far from it. And my heart kind of got caught up in my throat, and I'm sitting there, and it's like, so I'm like, my brain can identify this. So I'm right now, and I'm in a serious amount of distress. And then it turned, because I'm thinking, okay, this could be, Carolyn, you could have just swam out to a very big shark, because whatever it is, it's big. And then it kind of went underneath me, and it was a very large manta ray.
Oh, wow.
And when manta rays, you know, they have wingtips, and when the wingtip breaks the surface, it looks like a fin, which could be either a shark fin or a dolphin fin. But I was just so gleefully swimming out to this thing thinking, oh, I know what it is. And then when I couldn't figure out what it was, I was a bit freaked out. And I was like, you know, this is a good lesson. Don't just blindly swim out to something that you don't know what it is, unless you have a backup plan. And right now my backup plan is still on the beach getting a stand-up paddleboard ready.
God, but a manta ray, that's on my bucket list. But do you see them often?
They're here. We have quite a few. We've got a large population of them. We saw them quite a bit in the middle of summer. I haven't seen that many lately. But when you come to Hawaii, we'll take you out and we'll go dive. We know where they are every evening. They go to a feeding station provided by ultraviolet lights provided by the tourist boats. So the tourist boats drop a light bar in the water. It attracts the plankton, and then they affix the tourist to the bar like a snack bar. And then the manta rays come up to feed on the plankton that's attracted to the light, and they will like barrel roll underneath you, like brush against you, and just as they're feeding, because they are, you know, they're eating the plankton and the and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, they're gorgeous. It's fun, but we can go crash the snack bar.
I'm there. Once lockdown's over and I've got the cash in the bank, I'm straight there. So I've been really excited about asking this next question.
Okay.
So this next question normally goes like this. Someone once said to me, always remember that the water wants you. But now I can say, you once said to me, always remember that the water wants you, which I've always, from the moment you said that to me 15 years ago, I've always used that in my head whenever I'm in the middle of a long set, or I'm doing an open water swim and I'm tired, or I don't want to be there, or whatever. So if you could take that idea, but like become omnipotent and create the perfect environment to swim in. I mean, I'm asking you this, who lives in one of the most beautiful places in the world to swim. If you could use a holodeck from Star Trek, if you know what that is, and create like a perfect environment to swim, could you do that? Is that possible?
In my mind or?
In your mind.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually it's twofold. There is a one in the ocean and one in a lake like Lake Tahoe, that because and actually, Will, I just lied. My first open water race was not in a ocean; it was in a lake, swimming across a YMCA lake and getting a candy bar for doing it twice. So I can very, very vividly picture two different environments. One is like more of an alpine lake with blue, crystal, fresh, drinkable water with pine trees all around it and wood smoke hanging, you know, on just kind of laying on the surface a little bit. So you get the mixture of those baking pine needles and a little bit of wood smoke mixed together. And then I can picture one in the crystal clear waters here of the Big Island that I get to swim in so often. Just clarity, depth, abundance of marine life, happy. Our water here is happy. It's clean. It's not stressed. It doesn't have environmental stresses from boats and from development. And the fish, you know, it's like, yeah, I can totally. And I love that how you say that the water wants you, because I think, you know, what we do is we return to the womb, so to speak, when we get in the water. We return to that embryonic state where we're warm and protected and in our water bubble. And when we want to get out, we just want to remember the water wants you here. That's great.
You said
that's a really good one. I know. And it's like, I had forgotten it.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
You talk in your book, like you always have a connection to Hawaii, and it took you till 2000 to move there. But you just said that the water's clean and the water is healing. Why do you think it took you so long to make that connection to Hawaii? If it was always there, was it just the right point in your life?
I think it was the right point in my life. And as this is described in the do-over, you know, I was kind of in this marching mode where after I got sober and then I got my health back, then I went back to school. So I got my brains back. Then I went back to university on a swimming scholarship. And then the next stage of my life was, okay, you're 36, you're sober, you now have a degree from university. Now the next step is have a family. And that scared me, you know, so having a family scared me because I have alcoholism in my genes and, you know, I would I be a good mother? Well, you know, women spend their entire life trying not to get pregnant. When you finally try and get pregnant and you're surprised you can't, you realize that, that was very painful. So I ended up, not becoming a mother, but going through all of the, fertility issues that surround trying to get pregnant. So moving to Hawaii was just this next stage of my life, because I had thought that I would be raising a family in San Diego. And when there was no family to be raised, it was like, well, why not untether from someplace I'd lived since 1970? Yeah. And so it was, why not move to Hawaii? And it started out as just a tiny little idea that turned into a dream. And then you wonder if you could make that dream come true. And we did. And my husband, ex-husband, and my mom all moved over. And it was just a fresh start. It was a fresh start from the disappointment of all of the failed pregnancies. And when I came here, I needed some serious healing. Because up until that point, Will, I had been able to get my body to do everything I had asked of it. If I wanted to swim, you know, a 425, 400 meter freestyle and break a world record, I went 424. If I wanted to, you know, go under 220 in a 200 meter butterfly, I could do it. And I knew exactly what to tweak and how to make it work and what to train. And I got results. And for the first time in my sober life, here I kept doing everything I possibly could to get pregnant and to carry a child to term, and nothing worked. And I just felt like my body let me down. And so, and then we tried the fertility. And then, you know, once you get on the fertility merry-go-round, how hard that is on relationships. And so that was not good. So when I got to Hawaii, I was pretty broken and I knew I needed someplace different. And this was it. And the water did heal me.
That's beautiful. Having been there myself, I know how hard that is. But it could, I can only can't imagine how much more hard that would have been, considering everything that you brought with you to that point. I doff my cap to you. I really do. So,
but also, you know what? I also had to give myself a lot of forgiveness. Because now I've realized, learning this maybe 2 years ago, that my infertility was due to a STD that I probably picked up when I was drinking in when I was 18 or 19. Yeah. So poor choices in my youth, I'm just going to say it, unprotected sex, what ended up resulting in an STD that turned into pelvic inflammatory disease that probably compromised my ability to carry. And so I look at kids these days, and you think you are making these choices that you want to say yes to and yes to, and that is true, but there's also things that you want to say no to, because you think that maybe saying or agreeing to this act with a person is not going to have consequences. It's so big deal. You know, I slept with that person. I don't feel good about it, but oh well, carry on. And then you realize that something you did as a teen or an early 20 something has a lifelong lasting implication. We need to think more about those choices. It's in the moment, it might seem like a good idea, or not even not that bad of an idea. If you could look down and see, you know, your older version of yourself and go, wow, what could I have done different? And that was drinking related. You know, that was letting my guard down, being drunk. And I can look back at that and go, wow. Another one would be like smoking. You know, I have a friend of mine who is a massage teacher, and she's amazing. And we were talking about smoking, and she goes, oh, somebody offered me a cigarette one time. I turned it down. I said, you know what, Angela, if you had picked up that cigarette and you became a smoker, you would not be doing what you're doing today. You're a holistic healer. You would have never been that if you were a smoker. That's just not, those two wouldn't go together. Your lifestyle would have been very different. So sometimes it's the things that we don't do that have the biggest impact in our lives than the things that we do do. So sometimes it's good to say no. And that's this doesn't feel right, don't do it.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. That's also very philosophical about those choices. Yeah, and thank you for being so candid. That's lovely to hear. So, Carlin, my final question to you is, where was your last swim and how was it? And please try not to make us too jealous.
My last swim was just like 2 days ago. I had a client in town from the Bay Area. We've had really big surf, and that means our water clarity is not great. And so I took him to my favorite beach that's about 5 minutes away. It's called Kahalu. And Kahalu is really cool. It's a very that's very sacred area. There was a lot of Hawaiian population, royalty lived there. And it's a beautiful little kind of protected cove. And then outside the jetty or the rock break, which they don't know who created it, there's a beautiful reef on the backside of it. And so I take this guy from the Bay Area who's used to swimming in cold, murky, dark water. And we swim, and I put a pair of fins on him, and we go out, and I'm just like, it's bouncy. Like even the bay is bouncy. And then we get through the surf, and I said, okay, just go. You can't go too deep under the waves. because there's rocks and coral underneath there. So just let them just kind of bubble over you like a jacuzzi. And we punched out through the surf, and then we went around the backside, and there's these beautiful drop-offs and the fish. And I just was like, I'm trying to see it through his eyes. And he pops his head up and he goes, oh my God, this is amazing. And I go, yeah, it is. And I was thinking, how many times have I swum at that spot in COVID? 100 maybe. And it's freaking amazing. And I still have that awe and wonder every time I swim it. And it's my local beach. It's right where it is. And we didn't get a chance to swim all the way to the cave. That would have been really fun, but it was a bit far. And I think he was getting a bit tired, but it just, two things. It made me appreciate how beautiful it is here in Hawaii and how much diversity we have as far as open water swims. And that's why my swim camps are freaking awesome. And number two is that I got to share it with this guy. It was called an adventure swim, and it really was an adventure. Mm-hmm. And on the way back in, we had to swim back towards where we, the little beach, and you're actually swimming into the current because the waves are breaking from the opposite side. So it's a bit like an endless pool, you know, and it's only 4 feet of water. So there are fish are right underneath you. There's the Humunumunukuapua'a, and you're right there. And anyway, so the water is still 77 degrees. It's warm. It's clear enough for everybody. And our water just makes me smile. And getting to share that experience with somebody else is just, I can guarantee you that my client Brent will never forget that swim.
That's phenomenal. Yeah. I'll remember that as I'm swimming around Brighton Pier in late May, slightly cold and wanting to be in. I think if I was in Hawaii right now, I'd be going, hell yeah, with Carlin, rather than going,
hell yeah,
I'm cold.
It's just so amazing. So what makes the island of Hawaii so unique? And people get it confused with the main island, which is Oahu, but we are the island of Hawaii, also called the Big Island, is we are the only place on Earth that is gaining in land mass. So our volcano is producing more land, like the last flow added, I don't know how many hectares and whatever. But so Madam Pele is giving birth to new Earth. And so it's a dynamic, it's not static. It's a dynamic, like where the lava flowed 2 years ago was a beautiful fish pond area with natural springs and thermal pools, all got covered up. But what was left behind was a new black sand beach. And you go there and you go, wait a second. It's like your remodeling job. You're going to go back to your house and go, this is not the same house. Well, how many places on earth do you go back to and go, 1 year it's this year and the next year it's completely different. So yeah. I think we can take a lot from that with Madam Pele as far as rebirthing. I think COVID is a time of rebirth, regeneration, and renewal. That we all need to come out of this experience with COVID as different people. And now, instead of saying, oh my gosh, I have to go to swim practice, or I've got this on my schedule. People are like, oh my gosh, I get to swim. I get to swim. I got a lane. It's only 30 minutes, but I got a lane. So this whole pandemic has created cold water swimmers, open water swimmers, people that appreciate our sport that have never appreciated it. It was always like, you know, I always used to say to triathletes, the path to the bike leads through the water. So you got to get through the water. And you know what? When those three sports, when you get older, the last sport standing is going to be swimming. And you have a lifetime to get it right. So, you know, work on your techniques, sign up for a workshop, get some useful information, feel good about your success in the water, love the water, be playful water. Don't judge yourself all the time. Just get in and play, and she will heal you, and she will heal this earth. It's being healed right now.
Yeah. Just keep swimming.
Just keep swimming.
Lovely. Carlin, thank you so much. That was such a beautiful chat. And again, I thank you so much for your honesty and how candid you were. It was so lovely to hear.
Perfect. Hey, Will, I have something for your audience. My book is available on Amazon, mm-hmm. In UK as well as in Australia and the United States. Mm-hmm. But if you do not have the means to purchase a book, I have a PDF version of the book I would gladly send to anybody in need or for somebody that thinks that somebody else needs it. So if they would just send me an email to fasterfreestyle@gmail.com. Free of charge, I will send you an electronic version of the book. It's not a Kindle version. It's more like flip through the pages of electronic book. But my goal is to get this book to the people that need to read it.
That's very, very kind of you, Carlin. I'm sure people are going to love that. Thank you.
I think we can all take a breath after that. Just to give you that email address again, it's fasterfreestyle@gmail.com. And thank you again for Carlin for offering to do that. She really means it, so if you would like the book, please, please do so. Also, thank you to Carlin for being so frank and ingenuous during that chat. I think you'll agree she's definitely an inspirational powerhouse to listen to. Wow, gosh, that is the end of episode 8, and we have 4 to go until the end of season 1. I can't believe how quickly the time has flown, so... I mean, if you are enjoying the podcast, then please, please, please leave a rating on Apple Podcasts. It would be awesome, as it will really, really help keep the podcast being listened to and ultimately keep it alive for perhaps season 2 and season 3 beyond. Thank you so much to everyone listening. I'll be back next week. So until then, as we are a global audience now, happy swimming wherever you may be.